Chapter 25. Meanwhile. A light rain wetted the air of Zoran, warm and smelling of the turn of spring. The scent was not quite enough to hide the fragrance of brine wafting off the Aliani Sea. The seagulls, dense, stubborn birds that they were, circled the harbor anyway, looking to pillage the treasures of the fishing boats as they returned with the morning's catch.
"Stuff this," Todd griped, wiping his mouth on the back of his sleeve, and passing the flask over to Jodul. "How are we supposed to get anywhere now?"
Jodul shrugged in reply, already taking a swig.
"I mean, we all come up here together, you think we'd have, you know, finished up together," Todd continued.
He gave his friend a lost, plaintive look.
"Not the first time we got done by someone who didn't need us no more," Jodul replied,
licking his lips clean of the Hylai wine they had been drinking. He upended the flask and watched for any sign of further liquid to emerge, but the flask was empty.
"I mean, we've done our part, right? We got the kid to come see him. We ought to have gotten looked after a bit better, I think, that's all," Todd continued. "Deserved better, yep. Deserving don't do us no good, though," Jodul agreed. "I reckon we gotta figure the rest out on our own."
"Rest of what?"
Todd asked, a note of hope sounding in his voice.
"I ain't dead, neither are you. Rest of living through this old mess, that's all."
"You got some kind of plan?"
"Yeah,"
Jodul answered, declining to elaborate. From their vantage on one of the low rises north of the city, they watched as a transport ship unloaded. Scores of dark-skinned Narak soldiers filed down the docks and into the city. Magrin reinforcements. Todd waited for a time, watching Jodul for signs that he might volunteer his insights. Jodul's gaze hung obstinately on the small military procession, ignoring his compatriot's quizzical look.
"What is it?"
Todd asked when he could stand waiting no longer.
"You ain't gonna like it," Jodul told him, still staring off into the distance.
"Anything's gotta be better than moping round waiting for some Magrin to sniff us out and hang us," Todd countered.
"Spit, even walking back home would be better, taking our chances that the army don't see us."
At that, Jodul turned and glanced sidelong at Todd with half a smile.
"What? What's that look for?" Todd asked.
"We're enlisting."
The shushing hiss of steam drowned out any hope of conversation for the brief moment it lasted. Chains clattered through pulleys in rhythmic jerks as workers hauled something out of the chest-deep bath. The thing that emerged took on a sinister look in the reddish lighting of the foundry as water ran off it in a mass of small waterfalls, revealing a yellowish-brown metallic surface. Zoran was the first city in Magrin to have a proper goblin foundry. The bronze cannon barrel that they proceeded to set down on a pair of wooden cradles bore some resemblance to the works of art the goblins had brought to Rainsdark, but only so much as a child's drawing approximates the human form. It was ragged and irregular, with a pitted surface.
"Leave that one to cool. Next one,"
Kikhart directed, his voice stronger than it had been in many winters from having spoken so much Magrin of late. He still used a megaphone to make himself heard over the din of the workers, but they snapped to obey when they heard him. The goblin tinker trusted the workers to perform such simple tasks without his aid, and walked about the rest of the workshop to see how things progressed. An ox-driven rig of leather belts and wheels was spinning one of the cannon barrels axially, while a pair of human workers ground and polished the surface. A similar contraption was set up for reaming the bore, with a human working at the inner surface with a file, and one of Kikhart's few goblin workers taking measurements and directing the work. Woodworkers put together carriages, made ramrods, and helped repair and replace the numerous wooden fixtures that were used and battered throughout the workshop. A smaller table in one corner was surrounded by goblin artisans, who were casting the small components of the pull chain, sparkers, using a crucible the size of a teacup.
"How are today's deliveries?"
asked Lieutenant Damon Clads, Kikhart's nemesis, the McGrin Alliance Army's Junior Assistant Logistics Officer. The title junior denoted rank rather than age, for Lieutenant Clads was bald and graying in the mustache. The human was always disrespectful of Kikkart on his frequent visits, standing close and towering over him. His own workers had been trained to either speak to him from 3 of their paces away, or go to a knee to talk to him.
"There will be 12 today," Kikkart promised.
He had begun with 8 per day as his quota, but as the workers improved, he got more and more out of them. He hoped to be up to 15 per day within the 10-day. The junior assistant logistics officer harrumphed, but had no grounds for complaint. Kikkart met his deadlines without fail, and the quality was approaching what his own people had managed with the early prototypes.
"We have a lot of debts to pay off," Clads remarked, telling Kikkart nothing he did not already know. "See that they keep coming."
"Debts? Yes, I have debts to repay as well," Kikkart thought.
Kikkart nodded slowly in reply, not looking at Damon Clads at all. It was a cloudless night in Scar Harbor, the stars shining clear as the new moon gave them rain over the heavens for the evening. The lamplit streets muted the majesty of the night sky, but the side roads and byways bore no such hindrances. The carriage had been eschewed as well, in favor of a stroll through the brisk sea-watch air. It was a fleeting time of year, for by Greywatch, the nights would be too cold to enjoy at leisure.
"Do you think he will approve of me?" Abile asked, a note of doubt in her voice.
Thomas Harwick turned to face the girl whose arm was entwined with his, and smiled, finding her earnest self-consciousness endearing. He patted her arm with his free hand.
"I have had many an argument with my father over the years. I think he finds them to be an exercise of the mind more than a true quarrel. Lord Harwick is of keen mind and widely acclaimed judgment and wisdom.
He would put lie to all that should he find anything to disapprove of about you," Thomas reassured her. She smiled back at him.
"But if he does, well, we shall have our quarrel at a later date about that, in private."
They continued their walk in companionable silence. Abile kept her gaze largely skyward, allowing Thomas to guide them along the roundabout route to his estate. Thomas had initially had doubts about the wisdom of allowing himself to become enamored of a tradesman's orphan. It was a trap for the heart, surely, for when the families became involved and practical matters came into play, things were bound for ruin. He had been pleasantly astonished upon discovering that his father had no objection. Thomas's home was modest by the standards of Acardian nobility. Thomas lived alone, except for his servants and the occasional guest. The two-story manor house of granite walls and slate-tile roof suited his needs. The gate was open when they arrived. The carriage they had ridden to dinner had preceded them back to the estate by nearly an hour. Lord Harwick was awaiting them in the back drawing room when they arrived. His lordship had been passing the time in contemplation, smoking a pipe and drinking some of Thomas's best brandy as he looked out into the darkness of the gardens. There was no mistaking that the two men were related. Though stouter of build, and with graying hair too short to tell if it would fall into curls like his son's did, the facial features were strikingly similar.
"Thomas!" the elder Harwick bellowed upon noting their arrival.
He extracted himself ponderously from the high-backed chair in which he sat.
"Your letters did not do your lady justice, it seems. I am Lord Dunstan Harwick."
"I am honored to meet you, your lordship. My name is Abile Tillman,"
Abile replied, curtsying with unpracticed grace. Thomas had schooled her on what to expect, but she had never dealt with nobility before meeting him.
"Indeed, you could be none other." Lord Harwick took her hand and kissed it. "Might I offer you a drink?"
Abile looked askance of Thomas, who gave a tiny nod of encouragement, smiling the whole time.
"Of course, your lordship," she said.
"Thomas, if you would be so good as to pour," Lord Harwick said, looking to his son.
The younger Harwick went to the liquor cabinet and retrieved an excellent vintage, pouring glasses for all three of them. They chatted for a long while, plodding through the necessary banalities of making formal acquaintance.
Thomas heard nothing from either of them that he had not already known, and his mind wandered. He knew his father's presence was only partly social. Abelay's involvement in the witch scandal had been far more prominent in his father's letters than any concerns about her station or character. Thus it was no surprise when,
"Thomas, if you would be so good as to allow us a time in private, I am afraid that my duties to the king must intrude upon our social gathering. That whole nonsense about a witch and the events that followed it were botched so badly that the records have been expunged, and I have taken it upon myself to set the official accounting in order," Lord Harwick said.
"Father, is this really the best time to have at this bone of yours?"
"Gnaw on it come mid-morrow if you must," Thomas replied.
"It's all right, Thomas. I have answered questions about those events enough times now to no longer take offense. I have nothing to hide," Abelay said, putting a hand on Thomas's knee.
"Indeed, there is no aspersion at all directed toward Miss Tillman. Her involvement, however, is a matter of some speculation after the obvious incompetence of the previous magistrate was brought to light. It is an unfortunate matter, and I believe one that will get no more pleasant with aging."
Thomas knew that his objection had been noted and overruled. He could do no more. Despite being in his own home, he was very much subject to his father's jurisdiction. Thomas graciously bowed and took his leave, adjourning to his study. Attempting to lose himself in literature proved not so effective a pastime. Thomas found himself checking his pocket watch, an heirloom from his grandfather. While of excellent repute in its day, the old sterile and forthright piece lost minutes an hour. His inquiries to the Errol workshop to refit it with workings of their own make had been met with polite refusal. The master insisted his logo be prominent on any piece of his. Thus Thomas kept uncertain track of how long his bell had been under questioning. While tempted to eavesdrop, it was below his station as a gentleman. Nearing distraction at having reread the same two pages of The Honor of Argus a dozen times without absorbing a word, he was finally granted a reprieve from his isolation. When he escorted Abelay to the carriage that would deliver her safely home, she seemed nearly asleep on her feet. Her eyes were glassy and focused poorly. She leaned against Thomas for support as he walked her out to the front gate, muttering sweet words of appreciation for the aid. After the carriage departed his view, Thomas turned and stormed as politely as possible back into the house to find his father.
"What manner of treatment is that for a young lady?" Thomas demanded, finding Lord Harwick back in the same chair as when he and Abelay had first arrived. "You would not have treated a high-born girl in such a way."
"Thomas, sit," Lord Dunstan Harwick instructed, his voice flat, calm, even. "I am a progressive man, champion of the lower classes, overseer of His Majesty's reform movement. It is not often I am accused of bias against the lowborn, and tonight will be no exception."
"Well, you certainly—"
"I was not finished," Lord Harwick snapped, forestalling Thomas's fountain of spewed indignities before it even had a chance to begin. "While the girl seems pleasant enough, comely and with a working mind between her ears, there will still be troubles if you pursue her seriously. I am of a mind to help considerably with cobbling over those difficulties, should you indulge me in a not inconsiderable favor."
"What sort of favor?" Thomas asked in a huff, trying not to give ground against his father.
"There are things you do not understand. There are matters of witchcraft that ought not come to light, which, due to several recent and a few upcoming events, will require discretion. You are in line to learn of these matters, and your discretion is crucial."
"What are you trying to tell me, Father?"
"Tell you? I will do more than just tell you."
The sounds of slippered feet on carpet and the wheezing breath of ancient lungs were periodically interrupted by a hollow clatter of steel. Though nearly blind, Axterion could hear well enough, and the echoes were leading him back to their point of origin. When he found his youngest grandson, Danilasis, was in Brannis's room, sparring with the Cadran Imperial Grand Marshal's old, disused suit of plate.
The steel armor hung in midair, wobbling from the latest blow of Daniel's broom-handled sword.
"Cease that cacophony at once," Exterian ordered,
bringing the two masses of wrinkles that passed for hands up to cover his ears, as Daniel slammed the wooden dowel hard into the chest of his imaginary opponent. Daniel turned, looking at Exterion with wide-eyed innocence, as if nothing at all was amiss.
"Hello, Grandpa,"
Daniel said, lowering his sword.
"I have to practice if I'm going to be a warlock someday."
"Is that so?"
Exterion replied, his tone suggesting that the question was rhetorical.
"Well, I seem to recall that warlocks need to know their arithmetic, and certainly their penmanship. It took me and three of the servants to get your tutor out of the storage closet."
"I'm going to the academy this autumn. I can learn all that stuff there, from sorcerers who are smarter than Chale,"
Daniel said.
"They won't teach me to sword fight there, though, so I have to learn that on my own."
"Chale is a fine young man and as smart as they come. We spared no expense in educating you, I trust you know."
"Not smart enough to get himself out of a closet," Daniel muttered.
"Just because you can lock the door with a ward and he cannot break it does not mean you are smarter than him," Exterian said. "He is a scholar and not a sorcerer. Now set all that rubbish aside and we can get you back to your lessons."
Daniel stared at his grandfather but did not move to obey. What might have begun as a look of defiance slid slowly into a sly grin.
"Make me."
"Hmm? What was that?" Exterian asked. "I may have misheard you just now."
"Chale isn't a sorcerer, Grandpa, but you are. Beat me in a draw and I'll go back to my lessons."
"It appears that I did indeed mishear you," Exterian began,
a note of menace creeping into his voice.
"Because I thought I just heard you challenge the former High Sorcerer of the Imperial Circle to a draw. That cannot be true, of course, seeing as how you are a young, unblooded pup who has yet to even practice in draws against his peers, while I was once the strongest sorcerer in the Empire. It also cannot be true, because I am a feeble old man, using what I have left of my source to hold on to the last few hours of life I have left in this creaky old corpse I walk around in. It would not be sporting. One might question the valor of a warlock, went around challenging graybeards in their twilight. But of course, I am certain I misheard you, correct?"
Danilasis nodded vigorously but said nothing. Exterion took the boy by the hand. With a quick, masterful tug, about all the magic he could manage, he unraveled Daniel's clumsy levitation construct. Brannis's armor clattered to the floor with a sound like a kitchen accident.
"Besides," Exterion said, "there is no one about you to judge a draw at the moment. And let me assure you, I am just about enough of a competitive, stubborn, spiteful old bastard to accept. I would teach you a hard lesson about humility, and it would cost you a grandfather. Now, let us get you back to your lessons, if Chale is in any fit state to teach for the remainder of the day."
"Can I practice more after lessons, at least?" Daniel asked, sounding hopeful.
"I suppose. I do not know why you are so set on becoming a warlock, though. Your Uncle Rashaan is rather an exception. Few of them lived long enough to become old and feeble like me. Take my advice. Aim to become High Sorcerer one day, not warlock. You get to work indoors, and the only people trying to kill you are friends and colleagues."
Daniel nodded respectfully but made no comment.
"The work is much the same, I suppose, but in all other respects I can scarcely imagine a greater adventure,"
Davin Chartler replied between sips of wine.
"As it should be, as it should be," agreed his dinner companion,
Oriadel Connaughton. The elderly former scribe to King Gordon was naught but skin and bones. His body's only task left seemed to be the carrying about of 40 years' wisdom, locked up in a hairless, age-blotched head.
"I must say I have missed it terribly. Once he warms to you a bit, you will find no better companion than His Majesty, you know."
"Indeed, I could only imagine,"
Davin replied. Expert Connaughton had known the king since they were both much younger men. If such a bond were even possible between Davin and his majesty, it would be years in the formation. The elderly scribe chuckled. It sounded like a wheeze. The older man looked all about the small dining room in the servants' wing of the palace, taking in everything, and clearly lost in reminiscence.
This was my home a long time, but I believe you cannot truly appreciate something until you lose it, or discover you are about to,
Expert Connaughton observed. Sensing that Connaughton was about to embark on a soliloquy, Davin did not step in to fill the gap in the conversation as Connaughton paused.
I had the ear of a king, and I think I had no small part in His Majesty's reforms. King Gordon is a man of reason, and you can appeal to a man of reason with logic and sense. I see a fair bit of that in you, Davin. Mind you, so do not withhold it from His Majesty. I had my little plans and intrigues on the side, of course, just like everyone at court, though my aims were at once both more humble and more noble. Disenfranchise the nobility. Focus on the greater good above personal gain. Let the smart folk run things. That was my advice.
Sound advice indeed, Davin murmured, drawing an approving nod from Expert Connaughton.
Yes, but I have one regret. One last task that I feel I need to pass along to you.
What is that? Davin asked.
Your former apprentice.
Kyrus?
Yes, Kyrus Hinderdale, Expert Connaughton said.
What a mess that was, Davin shook his head. I do not even know what to make of it all. Kyrus accused of witchcraft, murdering guards and escaping a jail cell in Scar Harbor. They even think he was consorting with Denric Zane. It seems far-fetched, but everyone believed it at the time.
Well, I had hoped to meet your Kyrus before that chaos swept him off to who knows where. If he were to return to Acardia, though, I suspect he would seek you out,
Expert Connaughton said, looking hard at Davin as he did so. I would hope the boy would have more sense than that, but I admit the possibility, Davin said, trying not to sound too hopeful. He missed Kyrus terribly, especially knowing that he had fled Acardia as a fugitive, and that his return was implausible.
Well, as I said, I had hoped to meet him personally, and I still do. If he comes to you, have him seek me out. However, I know that I have not much time left. I find my health failing faster than I had accounted for in my planning,
Expert Connaughton said, snorting in self-derision.
If the day comes when Kyrus returns, as I have expired, have him seek out Lord Dunstan Harwick in my stead.
Lord Harwick? Davin asked, perplexed. The magistrate?
That is the one. We are kindred spirits, you might say. He will want to see Kyrus, I am sure.
What makes Kyrus so important to you? If you do not mind my asking, of course, Davin hastily amended, remembering to whom he spoke.
I had certain suspicions about him after reading a book he copied. I have shared my suspicions with Lord Harwick, and he will look into them on my behalf if I am unable.
What sort of suspicions? Expert Connaughton paused for a moment, pursing his lips before answering.
I suspect we might be distantly related. I suppose that would be my suspicion.
On a moonless night, in a secluded vale, a slim, fey figure knelt in the mud, heedless of the white gown she wore. Tiny hands pressed lightly into the muck to support her as she hung her face over a puddle. Light radiating from that puddle cast her features in harsh relief against the dark of night, colors dancing in patterns too muted by reflection to make any attempt at ascribing meaning to them. With but a thought, half a thought even, she could have held herself aloft and clear of nature's grime, but the scenes she witnessed playing out before her held her rapt. She had not the thought to spare. A splash in the water shocked her from her reverie. The image in the puddle wobbled and warped as the echoing ripples of a rock's passing spread. She glanced about, startled, unused to being approached unawares.
Vyax!
Iliardra scolded when she noted the bronze-skinned intruder upon her privacy.
Why did you do that?
It seems you are becoming too attached to something you know will not last. You said yourself you expect him to fail, Vyax said.
I may have, but I keep seeing signs of hope, Iliardra countered.
Hope for which of them? Vyax asked, smiling like a cat who had just trapped a mouse in a corner.
I thought you had given up on Rashaan.
Both. It is the same hope. Redemption.
Vyax peered over her and into the vision in the puddle, a look of detached interest on his face. Iliardra watched him watch. A sudden look of disgust curled Vyax's features, and he cringed. Iliardra's eyes snapped wide as she spun about on her knees and looked to see what had befallen.
No!
She screamed when she saw. She slammed a small fist into the puddle, splashing both of them with crystal-clear water as her hand hit the muddy bottom. The spell ended, and the water became just water again. Leaping to her feet, the mud on her hands, knees, and dress sloughing off to leave every bit of her pristine, she ran off into the night, sobbing. Vyax watched her depart. He stood for a while, staring at the ruin of the scrying puddle. After a time, he shook his head slowly, shrugged, and walked off in a different direction.